Why don't we get started? They told me we could start anytime. Welcome, everybody. I'm Dr. Rona Novick. I come to you all the way from sunny New York. It's a little less gray than it is here today, but it's my pleasure to make another visit to Toronto. I love this city. And it's also my pleasure to talk about a topic that is very close to my heart. Not only as a clinical psychologist, but as the mother of three boys. I was saying in the cab ride over here that I have two teenage sons and one not yet teenage son who I've told is banned from becoming a teenager until at least one of the others graduates from their adolescence. I don't think that's going to happen, so I think I'm going to be saddled with three at the same time. But from the time I started working clinically with children and families, and certainly since I've been a parent, I've really struggled with how we raise good children in a world that sets such bad examples, and how we raise children who embody our Torah values, our secular values, in a world where sometimes badness seems to pay and the good guy finishes last. Sometimes I actually ask students and kids about all those myths that we hear, like good guys finish last and good things come in small packages, and you know, kind of challenge them. Do you really believe that they're true? And over the years, I've heard some interesting answers. But what I hope we'll do tonight is explore a little bit about where values come from, what we as parents can do to not only instill them but maintain them in our children, even in the face of today's challenges, and also hopefully not just talk at you but talk with you and be able to answer your questions and give you some hands-on resources for dealing with these issues with our kids. And I'll start out by saying that this is really, really important to raise children with values, if for no other reason than on a purely selfish level. A few months ago, I went grocery shopping in a store that is frequented by the elderly. It's right near a very large apartment house that has elderly people in it. And in front of the automated checkout was an elderly couple who could not make sense out of the automated checkout. And I stood there as the people in line after me are rolling their eyes and saying, oh gosh, these old people, they don't know how to do this, they can't manage it. And I actually tried to help the gentleman in front of me manage this self-scan checkout, and the person behind me said in exasperation, well, in just a few more weeks, they'll all be in Florida. And my response was, in a few more years, we'll all be them. And so, it is so important that we raise children with values, because very soon, sooner than we know, they are going to be the leaders as we age. They are going to be the pillars of our communities. They are going to care for us. And if we do not create children with values, then they are not going to be the children who care for us and our institutions and our communities in our golden years. So that's why I say it's selfish. But it also is good for them. Children who grow up with purpose, with value, with integrity, do better psychologically in all of the traumas and tragedies that today's children have had to deal with, whether they are children in Israel dealing with the constant pressure of living with the Intifada, whether they're children in New York living in with the after effects of 9/11, whether they're children in Florida dealing with an intense hurricane season. Research tells us that children who find meaning in life, the same as adults who find meaning and value in life, fare better. They're happier, they have less psychological distress, they have better academic outcomes, they are less likely to do drugs. So having meaning and value in your life is good for your health. So it's not just a selfish thing. Now, I have to tell you the sorry tale that children are not born with values. That if we were to borrow a page from David Letterman and talk about the top five reasons why children are not automatically valued, I don't mean they are not valued, we automatically value them, why they don't automatically come with values, the number five reason would be that they're born selfish. Anybody here met an infant who lays in their crib hungry and says, Ma, it's okay, feed the other ones first. Dad, you've had a tough day, it's all right, I'll sit with the diaper, get to me when you can. It is the nature of the human infant to say, give me, get me, take care of me. Me, 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 it's all about me. That's the way we're born. To some extent, it feeds survival of the species. It's good to kind of go for what you need and put your own needs first. Hopefully, by the time we get to the sandbox and to the preschool, and certainly by the time we get to adulthood, we have been acculturated to understand that it can't always be me, 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 me first, although I really do believe that just turn on the television set for any of the reality TV shows, and you could say, oh, well, here are some people who didn't learn that lesson and are still pretty self-centered and focused, self-focused. The number four reason why children don't come automatically with values is that it's good to be king. That if you can have power and dictate to others, that feels better than being dictated to. Ask children in nursery school, this looks like a nursery school room, as they learn the story of Pharaoh and Moses and the Israelites, which would you rather be, Pharaoh or the slaves? Most people are going to say, better to be king. I would rather be in charge of other people than do what other people tell me to do. The number three reason why children need to be taught values and it doesn't come naturally is that we let them have bad values or we teach them bad values. We let them demonstrate or learn bad values whenever they act in a selfish or inappropriate or non-compassionate or a way that lacks integrity right in front of our eyes, and we do nothing. Because if a child behaves in an inappropriate way in front of you and you do nothing, guess what message you send to your child? It's okay. Not only is it okay that you hit your littler brother to get what you want, or that you malign that girl in carpool because you don't really want to invite her over this Sunday for a play date. Not only is it okay that you did that, but if I'm giving you the green light to do that, maybe you could up the ante. Maybe it's okay to do something worse. In my house, and I'm by no means a perfect family, my best friend says, you know that expression about cobblers, children have no shoes? Well, what do you think they say about psychologists' children? We go on vacation with this family every year, and he threatens me that he's taking a video camera and he's going to expose me. Someday he's going to come to this conference. He'll show you what I'm really like. Anyway, in my house, there are two words I can't stand. Can't stand shut up. I cannot stand those two words. I find them crass. I find them rude. In my house, you're not allowed to say shut up. I already mentioned I'm the mother of three boys, two of them adolescents now. Believe it or not, despite the fact that I don't allow these words, it happens. They say shut up to each other. But every single time they say it, I say, can't talk to your brother that way. Please find a different way to tell your brother what you want. Please use better words. That's not the way we speak in this house. Every single time I say it, and my husband says, great and powerful Dr. Novick, it's not working. They still say shut up to each other. And I say, and if I weren't saying this, there are two other words you would be hearing at your dinner table. I am absolutely positive that they would have graduated or deteriorated to worse. That every single time you may think as a parent, okay, so I said don't hit, I said don't steal, I said don't lie, I said don't cheat. I think I'm spitting in the wind. I'm not dealing with my child's moral upbringing. I said it, they still do it. Do not for a minute think that you are not having an impact, because take that away and you wind up giving a green light and really communicating that that behavior is acceptable. I said we let them, but also we sometimes teach our children immoral behavior or poor values. Think about parents who, and maybe you're among them, I don't mean to malign anybody, who do not give accurate ages of their children when they go to the movie theater. Say that you are, can somebody open the back door there? Who say, you know, listen, we'll save a few bucks. We don't want to let them, look short. We're going to Disney, be short. Or come on, let's push in front of the line. We need to go first. Rav Twersky, I heard speak last year in Israel at a conference, and he said over something that changed the way I do things. I don't know if grocery stores are the same way, In Toronto as they are in New York, but grocery store parking lots are a free-for-all in New York. And as soon as you're finished shopping, you just take your wagon and, you know, people let them ride. And if they happen to land into your car, behind your car, so be it. So Rav Twersky said, if you're shopping with your children and you finish unloading your grocery wagon and you leave it behind another person's car, you're too busy. You can get out of your spot. You've now blocked somebody else. Or you leave it in an empty spot, blocking that parking spot for anyone else. He says, what are we communicating to our children? That on some level you're saying, we're the prince, our family's royalty, we have more importance and value than the people who drive that car. Let them move the wagon for us. And such a small little thing ever since I heard it. I can't go into a grocery store parking lot anymore, with or without my children, without making sure that my wagon doesn't block anybody's car. And it made me think about in what other ways, when my children are with me, subtly do we communicate the wrong idea? In what ways do we communicate that somehow we're special, we're better, we're deserving, and the other family waiting online or the other people don't have import? So that's how we let them and we teach them. But the number one reason why children do not demonstrate good values is because they're afraid to be good. And I'll tell, did I skip one? What did I skip? We let them, we teach them, it's good to be king. No, I said there are five, but there's four. I didn't skip one, I just have one extra in my head. Because this last one really has three parts to it. When I say they're afraid to be good, I do believe that by the time children are of school age, that most of them have either from the values we've taught them or from the positive values that they hear in school, they know it's good to share. They know I'm supposed to tell the truth. They know these things intellectually. They're very well aware of them. And when they don't, it tends to be out of fear. For very young children, this can happen, and parents will say, they'll come to me all the time and say, my child's a liar. My child has no values. My child lies. They broke the vase. The broken pieces are in their hand, and we say to them, what did you do? Did you break mommy's vase? No. They're holding the broken vase in the hand. No, I didn't do it. Below the age of 5 or 6, children believe in giving you what you want. It's really their good nature. It's their good neshamas that want to tell you what you want to hear. They want to say, mommy doesn't want me to have broken the vase, so I want to say I didn't break the vase. Daddy doesn't want me to have knocked over his trophy, so the correct answer here is, no, I didn't do it, even though the evidence very clearly points to the opposite. And to call that child a liar is really unfair. At that age, children, in that moment, when you have competing honesty versus give my parent what they want, what's going to win is to give you what you want. If they're 20 and they're telling you they didn't smash up the car, different story. Different story that's operating here. Now they know a little bit better, certainly over the age of 6. But think about the child who, and I'll talk a little bit about a pet peeve of mine, which is bullying, because it's an example where children's values and their peer relationships are tested to the utmost. Think about the child who witnesses their friend or a peer being bullied and stands by and does nothing. 9 times out of 10, the reason that child does not act is fear. Either I'm afraid that if I act, if I get involved, if I try to do the right thing, somehow I'll be punished. The bully will, God forbid, come after me. Or that it will be social suicide, that I will become a pariah, that people will say, oh, well, Rona sat with Marcy on the bus, and Marcy's a loser, so now Rona's a loser. We don't want to hang with Rona anymore. And in fact, some of the biggest challenges to children in terms of growing up with values come from peer relationships and from peer issues. And bullying is only one of them, and I'll probably allude to it a little bit more in a little while. I want to talk, though, about what we as parents on a very practical level can and should do to get over these phenomena that make it difficult for children to develop values. And let me just talk about those three things on that, these are from slides that I have on that slide. The Prisoner's Dilemma, Power to Conform, and the Dehumanization of Victims, because these are things that make it hard for even the most kind-hearted and good-natured of children to maintain their values. Prisoner's Dilemma is a very famous study that was done by Stanley Milgram years ago. It would be banned now. It would never be allowed to be done. Does anybody need people who came in late? There are handouts here. No problem. You know what, if you want to put on the table in the back so that if anybody needs, here's more, that they're left back there, so if anybody comes in late, they can get it. Thank you. So Milgram did an amazing experiment that would no longer be allowed today. He had what people thought were prisoners in a room behind a glass booth, hooked up to what looked like an electric shock apparatus to their fingers. And he brought in graduate students and also hooked up what looked like an electric shock to your finger. And he said, I have to deliver a light, small voltage electric shock. Either I could give it to that guy on the other side, he's a convict, or I can give it to you. What do you want me to do? Guess what people chose? Give it to the other guy. By the way, there was no live electric current in any of the wires. The guy wasn't a convict, he was an actor. And there was a light that was signaled every time Milgram pushed his button so the actor could act as if he got a little jolt. The experimenter explained, this is a study on pain and on tolerance of pain, so I have to now increase the voltage a little bit. So now it's a little higher volt. Who gets it? You or the next guy? What do you think people said? Give it to him. And even as the amperages were increased and increased to a point where the experimenter is now starting to look worried, saying, I don't know if he can take much more, people almost universally elected to give near lethal doses of shock to another person rather than themselves. The experiment was modified and redone multiple times, thinking at first people said, well, it's because it's a convict. People want to punish convicts. It was done with graduate students. It was done with same gender, cross gender, the same findings, that people will punish another person to save themselves from punishment. Why is this relevant when I talk about children and values? Because the same way that that child says, I didn't break the vase when it's broken in their hands, so that they're opting to lie to avoid punishment, they're opting out of inflicting punishment on themselves. It's the same principle that happens when children witness cruelty in their environment, when they see peers act in an inappropriate way. A big issue in high schools now and in middle schools is cheating, so they'll see a peer cheating. But they would rather not have anything negative happen to themselves, and so they will do nothing. They will not act, even though they feel the appropriate thing to do is, I should report this, I should go forward, I should do something. They will not act for fear that somehow I'm going to be harmed. So we just have to keep that in the back of our mind. In terms of the power to conform, another experiment that was replicated recently, it's still allowed to be done. Imagine yourself sitting in a room with nine other panelists. And you're told, we're going to ask each one of you to do a very simple task. We're going to show you a line. The line is this long. And we're going to ask you to look at three other lines and tell us which one matches. And line A, it's a clear match. Line B is tiny, clearly doesn't match. Line C is huge. Any idiot would know that line A is the right answer. You're sitting in chair number 10, and the person in chair 1 says line C is the right answer. You scratch your head and say, ugh. Person needs glasses. And the person in chair 2 says line C is the right answer, and chair 3, and chair 4, and chair 5. All 8 people before you, 9 people before you, give the wrong answer, and you, brave, courageous, well-sighted person that you are, answer the first time, A. Absolutely A. You know your right answer. If this is repeated enough times, and by the way, if you haven't figured out already, the first 9 chairs are filled by confederates of the experimenter who has told them whatever the first person says, you agree with, whether it's correct or not. What you see happen, I actually have a videotape of this experiment, what you see happen over time is that people go from a bold discussion of A is the right answer to A, to looking quite depressed and upset as they say A, and 80% of college students, adults, 80% wind up giving the wrong answer to conform. again, replicated with housewives, with businessmen. 80%. Every time I tell the story, I get a little shiver, because we are asking, sometimes when we're asking our children to be people of integrity, to have the courage to stand up for their values, we are asking them to go beyond what we know is typical human nature in these situations. And so we have to be very well aware that is operating. And the last thing I want to talk about is just the phenomenon of dehumanization of victims. We know that if you see somebody placed in the victim role for long enough, that you either make them invisible or you blame them for their torment. Again, when we talk about children who in their peer relationships may act, there are chairs and there are handouts, please make yourself comfortable. When we talk about children who in their peer interactions may act in a way that we say isn't consistent with values, they're just picking the kid who has the best stuff rather than their best friend, and they're being too materialistic and not being truly valued people, that we have to realize that children also, if they witness a particular child being scapegoated, being victimized, being ostracized, being left out, that they begin to either see that person as a non-entity. They'll literally begin to forget that that's a member of their class. One of my own children, it broke my heart, came home in second grade and said, "We're going on a trip, but not Benji. We're going to go make pizza, but not Benji. We're going to," you know, and I said, "Well, who's this Benji character?" "Well, Benji can't learn." How does a second grader know Benji can't learn? Obviously heard from adults. Benji can't come. Benji can't behave. Benji can't learn. Benji. The child had been so ostracized and victimized that the whole rest of the class just kind of ignored him, forgot him, didn't include him. In this case, it really was the adults who made the problem more than the kids. What can we do? What can we do to get over and around these forces that make it not so easy to raise children with values? And by the way, I'm also not talking about one extraordinarily powerful force in our children's lives, and that is the media. I just finished writing an article I have to email it tonight or tomorrow, on children growing up too fast. And as I'm trying to explain why the precocity, why do we have 3-year-olds who want to dress like 10-year-olds and 10-year-olds who want to wear makeup like 20-year-olds and kids who want, my 12-year-old wants a cell phone. I said, "What are you, Meshuggah? What are you, a crazy person?" I said, "When your brother got his license at 17, 16 and a half, 17, where I live, that's where you get your license, that's when he got a cell phone and not before. For a safety issue, he needs a cell phone." So what do you think my 12-year-old says to me? Well, it's not fair is part one, that we hear always as parents, but everybody else has a cell phone. But everybody else has a palm, a tungsten, a this, a that, Vivace. I don't know. To me, I'm still stupid. I think phones, you make phone calls on. Not that you play games, you email, you BlackBerry. I don't know. To me, you call it, you answer it, you dial it. That's all. My kids, if they didn't teach me how to program the numbers, I wouldn't know how to speed dial. And I'm pretty technologically literate, but I'm just, you know, like to me, an appliance is what it was made for, you know. The point is that we have enormous impact both on the part of peers and the media that are pushing our children to do more and more, younger and younger. And certainly the vast wasteland of television is not necessarily the best place for your children to learn values. If you turn on the TV virtually any day now in prime time, on a regular basis, I am shocked at what is allowed to be shown at 8 o'clock at night. I'm not talking 10 o'clock. I'm not talking cable. I'm also, everybody else has cable, Ima. I have no cable. I'm such a cruel parent. I have no cable in my house. It's horrifying. I figure 13 channels is enough to fight over. I don't need 50 to fight over. You have any night at 8 o'clock, in addition to the sex and violence, what I find even more disturbing is that at 8 o'clock at night, you can be told you're the ugly duckling, not the swan, you're fired, you're not good enough to marry my father, you're not the prettiest bachelorette or bachelor, and you're voted off the island. Honest truth, a sixth grade class in a school where I consult decided that they didn't like the people who sat at their table, and they were going to vote somebody off the table. And if you remember The Weakest Link, that was another one. You know, you are the weakest link. There is such an element of competition, finger-pointing, and the way we do better is by putting other people down in popular TV now, that I think some of the most dangerous things are not what a lot of the right-wing groups are fighting to get off of TV. To me, I'm more concerned about some of the subtle things. What can we do? I want to talk about three main areas that we as parents have huge impact on with our children, and that I would like to suggest are the places where you have an opportunity to teach values or to communicate values in a way that are going to be effective. And that is communication, modeling, and discipline. And I'll talk about all of them, and then we'll discuss them as best as we have time. Now, it's so easy to say communication. When's the last time you had a great conversation of meaning with your child? It's so hard. My next talk is on time management, so it kind of goes together. It is so hard. How many people in the room here have more than one child? How many people in the room work in addition to being parents outside the home, work outside the home? You're always working as a parent. It's the, you know, the other job you go to is your vacation from parenting. It's much less hours and better rewards, less stress, exactly. It's why I'm in Toronto. My husband said, "What do you suggest for dinner?" And I said, "I suggest you feed them." And I suggest you not ask me from the plane what to do about dinner, please. And my parting words were to my 12-year-old, "Take care of your Abba. Make sure he eats tonight," because he's the resident chef in our house. So it's easy to say communication. It's hard to accomplish it. And it's also so much easier to talk about the unimportant stuff than to talk about the important stuff. So here are some pointers about communication. First is you have to make opportunities for talk. And it may seem stilted and silly to say, we're going to sit down at dinner and everybody give me your best and your worst. What was the best thing that happened to you today? What was the worst thing? You have to make silly family rituals. You have to make, I remember to this day, you know, graduate school in clinical psychology is rather demanding. Thank God I was not a mother at the time. All I had to do was be a student. But I remember how hard it was to get a PhD in psych and, you know, really worked very, very hard. My colleagues would all say to me, "Rona, we don't know how you do it with Shabbos." And I would say to them, "I don't know how you do it without it. This is my one island of sanity." And I think also raising a family, having a day that everybody, I'm guaranteed on Friday night, we're all at the table together, makes a huge difference for families that have that. If you do not have that ritual, then make another ritual. Make a family game night. Make a time for conversation. I can't believe I'm saying this, but driving lessons, when I taught my sons to drive, it's enforced conversation. They can't leave the car. They can't walk to another room. You know, now obviously in the middle of serious driving lessons, you don't say, "So you're dating anybody?" Not a good thing. No, don't bring up important subjects. It is easier to talk about easier topics, so that's often the place you want to start, is with easier, start conversations with easier things and be sneaky and wind your way into harder things. Anticipate crises. Do not talk with children about although materialism knows no limits now, you know, I hear five-year-olds asking for materialistic things, but a big time for materialism comes with the entry into elementary school and also, I find, with camp. That around, I want to go to sleepaway camp, I want to go to this camp, I want to go to that camp, and children now have to confront realities of what parents can and cannot afford, what camp you're comfortable with in terms of the different kinds of camp environments. Well, don't wait till it's everybody else is registered, and now you have to sit your child down and talk about, well, we don't really believe in sending five-year-olds to sleepaway camp in our house, nor could we afford it, or, you know, it's not what we do. We spend summers together as a family, and then maybe when you're a teenager, you go away, whatever it is, your family's decision, and I don't mean to put anyone down who does send five-year-olds to sleepaway camp. If that's what works for you, fine. But if that's the issue, you should be talking about it before the summer begins. I had a wonderful opportunity. You know, one of the things being a therapist is that I get a preview of what's coming up in my children's lives because I often see patients a little bit older than them. So about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I had a female patient come to me who was a girl who was in a yeshiva who had just come back from yeshiva break, going to Florida alone with girlfriends, no parents. And boy, did she have stories that every hair on my head turned gray from this, and it's not my child. Just nervous. I was so nervous about the sex, drugs, and rock and roll that was going on in Florida over break with all of these yeshiva kids, good Jewish boys and girls, totally unsupervised. I came home, and at the time, my oldest child was 12 years old, and I said to him, about 4 or 5 years from now, you are going to come to me, and you are going to ask me if you and your buddy boys can go down to Florida alone in a hotel room, hang out at the beach. The answer is no. Okay? By the way, came to me this year. He said, you know, Ema, I earned a lot of money over the summer. A couple of guys were going on vacation. I want to use that money for Florida. And I said, I broke out hysterical laughing. And he said, why? You think it's so funny we can't go? I said, no, I already answered the question 4 years ago. You're not going. My problem was solved. In New York, none of the schools had the same vacation week. Thank God. So I didn't have to deal with it. Use the indirect approach when talking about difficult values issues. If you sit your child down and say, you know, the way you're handling your best friend, or I hear that there's cheating going on in your school and the way you're dealing with it, or all you seem to want is stuff. You come to me constantly saying, buy me, get me, give me. You know, it's not nice. The mensches don't do this. Let's not do this. If you use that direct approach and talk about your child's experience, they're going to feel defensive. They're not going to be so open. They may, if they're very sensitive kinds of children, they may, you know, look kind of sad and kick their feet in the sand and feel dejected that they've disappointed you. And if they're hands on the hip kind of kids, then they're going to say, no, I don't. How do you know that? That's not true. I didn't do that. So you're not going to get very far with the direct approach. You have to be very sneaky when you want to communicate about values with kids. And one of my favorite ways to be sneaky is to use the very media that I just maligned. So watch TV or go to movies or read books with your children. And they, by the way, will be full of opinions about values about the characters in movies. If you ask them about a character in a movie or a popular TV show who cheated or who abused a friend or who chose materialism over true values, they'll be the first ones to catch it. They'll say, oh, that guy was an idiot. I wouldn't want a friend like that. Well, now we can sneak from that to saying you wouldn't. How is that different than what happened last week at school? Start with the safe stuff. And things from movies and books are safe. And then move into, has that ever happened with you? Does that ever happen with your friends? Does that ever happen with anybody? You can even do it with news stories. There was a horrible story in the Northeast recently of a party gone bad, also of Jewish teenagers, 42 arrested in a drug and alcohol bus for having a party unsupervised while parents were away. You know, it made all the newspapers in the Northeast, and certainly all kids in Jewish schools heard about it. So it was very easy for me to go to my children and say, could that ever happen here? Now, had it happened in my neighborhood, I don't think I would have gotten such honest answers. But they were actually very open in talking about how it's the same and how it's different than the situation they find themselves in. You need to find shared interests, because as children are little, but certainly as they grow older, they like to be different from us, just to make us miserable, just to rib you a little bit. So you may have enjoyed fishing together for years, now all of a sudden, hate fishing, fishing's not cool. You may have to shift your interests in order to stay connected and keep the lines of communication open. And if it means becoming, I mean, I can tell you more about sports than I ever thought I would know in my life. But as the mother of sons, it's been required learning. It's the way that I can connect with them. And by the way, we can have very good discussions about materialism and values based on what goes on in the sports world, whether it was that horrific fight that broke out in the stands, or the amounts that pro ball players get played that are like absolutely ludicrous, that even my sons will say, it's sinful. There are so many people in the world who need things and hear people who have way too much. Of course, that's being proactive. That's saying, well, communicate when there aren't troubles or problems. But life is sometimes going to force us to communicate in times when there are problems and there are difficulties. And one of the things that I think is very important when you are dealing with a value-based situation and it does come to light. You find out that your child knew about cheating, or there was bullying in the school and your child stood by, or God forbid has been involved directly in the bullying, or your child is involved in behavior that you don't approve of. One of the most important things you have to do is give your child permission to tell you things you don't want to hear. Now, that doesn't mean saying, whatever you hear, whatever you tell me, I'll love you just the same. It will be wonderful. I'll give you hugs and kisses. I'm never going to say that because, believe you me, there are some things you're going to tell me, I'm going to get pretty angry. And I'm going to have to give consequences if there are certain things you tell me. I don't want to be the parent who cried wolf who says, whatever you tell me, it will be okay. No, you tell me you cracked up the car, you're going to have to pay for the repairs. I can't promise you carte blanche. But I can promise you that I'll listen. I can say that I will respect all the hard work it takes you to be honest with me. I know that it's tough to come clean, and I'll respect that a lot more. And I also can tell children, whether they're the children I work with or the children I raise, I can tell them that I will always be more disposed to be generous, lenient, positive, if you're honest with me, than if I find out after the fact that you weren't. And if there was something I gave you the opportunity to tell me and you chose not to, because honesty is so, it's so important in our communication. So, you know, if you tell me, I know I was supposed to be home at 8, but I was having so much fun that I couldn't leave their house and I stayed longer, that's going to be better than if you tell me some big story about, well, my bike tire blew out and then I had to go to the mechanic and I find out you weren't even riding your bike. And, you know, you were at 17 different places than where you were supposed to be, or you forgot your homework, and that's the whole problem that happened. There are other pointers here, like to discuss the level of confidentiality. If not only a teenager, but any child comes to you to talk about things that are happening in their life or in school, again, I try not to promise I won't tell anyone else. A child once came to me and shared their concerns about another child who was playing with firecrackers. Now, I could not, in good conscience, not pass this news on. But I problem-solved with the child who told me. I said, listen, I know you don't want your friend to get in trouble, but I also know you don't want your friend, God forbid, to lose a finger or to blow up their house or to get carted off to jail. It's illegal where we live to use fireworks without a permit. We don't want any of those things to happen. So who could we tell? How can we handle this so we keep your friend safe? So I won't promise anything you tell me is a secret, but I will promise that before I tell someone else, we can talk about it. It's very helpful for parents to share their own struggles and feelings, but be cautious. When you talk about the old days, when you were a kid, when it snowed every day and you walked 40 miles uphill both ways to the schoolhouse, if you notice them getting glassy-eyed, you know, doing this, move on. What they really want to hear from you is that you can relate to their struggles, is that it wasn't so easy for you. I probably say about 3,000 times a week to kids from 5 to 25 in my office, I wouldn't be your age again if you paid me. I know how tough this is. I can only imagine how hard it is. And kids just want to be validated. And every time we say, yeah, well, you think it's hard. You know what it was like for me? Well, your grandfather... It doesn't validate them. They feel dismissed as if somehow their problems are not heard or not understood. So we don't want to do that. Or I'm the first one to admit I don't have all the answers. You want to be very careful that you're not Miss Pollyanna. Well, just say no. When all the girls are leaving out another girl, you invite her to sit with you. When everybody else has Palm Pilots and cell phones, you just say, those things aren't important to me. I know what's valued in the world. You know, oh, come on. Your children will laugh you out of the room. You need to recognize how difficult the task is that we're asking kids to do. And that don't, I just heard at a lunch with mutual friends yesterday of a friend in our neighborhood who's buying a bigger house. And don't you know the conversation around the table? What do you think? What's everybody talking about, these people who are buying a bigger house? Do you think everybody is saying, good for them, we're so happy for them? Or do you think there was just a little bit of green going around the table? Well, if grown-ups get jealous and are materialistic, we can't expect children to see somebody have a shiny new bike or go on a better vacation and not wish for it. And it's okay to say to kids, I know you wish for it. I wish for it, too. That's natural. That's a human emotion. But we're can we be better than that? Can we make wise decisions? The other thing I'm going to say a lot of times is keep trying, because conversations and discussions with kids are never one-time things. They are ongoing. Parenting's 24/7, 365 days a year, and luckily we get do-overs. Endless do-overs. You don't like how it went today? Do-over. Let's have that conversation again. And you keep doing it till we get it right, hopefully. The next area I want to talk about is modeling. Whether you like it or not, you're a role model all the time. All the good things you do, you're modeling. All the bad things you do, you're modeling. While your children are saying, I hate you, you're the worst parent in the world, they're still copying you, you're still having an impact. While they are apparently rejecting you, trying to be totally different than you, you are still having an impact. And you never know, sometimes till days, months, years later, the impact that your modeling has had on them. So realize that you are always teaching, and one of the things you can do to increase the power of your positive role modeling, it's going to sound crazy, but talk to yourself out loud. We all do some pretty great things as adults. We all make good value decisions a lot of times, but we make them privately. Our children never know we've made them. When we help an elderly person in the street, we just help that elderly person. That's it. End of discussion. But if your child is with you and you say, you know what, that felt pretty darn good. I'm not usually so patient with older people, but you know, before I know it, I'm going to be one of those people. And it felt really nice. And look how they shone at how I helped them. It took so little to get them to smile. Kind of made my day too, didn't it? That little talking out loud, although it sounds like lunacy when you're running a narrative of your life all day long, it makes an impact on children. To say on Friday afternoon, as you're about to go call grandma or grandpa who's under the weather, you know what? Such a busy day, but I have to find time to call grandma or grandpa because this phone call means so much to them. And they're sitting alone, and the snow has got them snowed in Chicago or in Toronto or wherever they're snowed in. Wouldn't they like a phone call? Maybe I'll put one of you guys on the phone so you can talk. Make your internal value script external so that your children benefit from hearing it. And finally, look for famous examples that you do value. The newspaper and the media are always going to find the bad guys. They are going to do endless days of Roger Clemens when he throws his bat. We are going to hear about every ruthless dictator and every corrupt CEO. But every once in a while, we're also going to hear about Tzaddikim. We are going to hear about the people of our day and time who are incredible role models for our children. And they may come from the secular world, and they may come from, God willing, from our own religious heritage. But wherever they are, find them and tout them for your children and underscore them, because you can't depend that the media is going to say, look what wonderful things this person did. One of the nicest things that happened to me this year, my eldest son is applying to colleges, which is kind of irrelevant to the story, although it wound up going in his college essay. And in ninth grade, he read Natan Sharansky's book. So this year, Sharansky spoke in New York. And I have to tell you, when a 17-year-old boy, who usually is hawking you about getting the car, can he have money for going to a concert, and all the things you don't approve of, says, do you think you could get me tickets to go after school into, I don't live in Manhattan, after school into Manhattan to go hear Sharansky speak? I said to his father, you drop everything, you get him those tickets. And he, when he comes back from hearing Natan Sharansky speak and is waxing eloquent about from the gulag to his latest book is about touting the power of democracy and what an impact this has had on him, this is a golden moment to say, you just met a hero. You met an incredible, whether I agree with his politics, whether I disagree, you met a modern day superhero. And you know what he said when I said this to my 17 and a half year old son? He said to me, next I want to hear Elie Wiesel speak. if we point out the right heroes to our children, the heroes that have values, that teach what we want to teach, they will look for more like them. And we have to get beyond the, you know, I turned on the news. If I hear Brad Pitt or Jennifer Aniston's name one more time this week, I'm going to be nauseous. We have to look beyond the heroes that the magazines and the media tell us are heroes, and we will find them. And our children will resonate with them. And even my middle son, who's not so politically charged, is an absolute sports buff. So even to find the athletes who do give of themselves, who are self-effacing, who would never do anything to be in the middle of a media circus, that also is a way to underscore values. Just a little thing about money. Just a little, you know, on one foot, al regochad, a little about money, because, you know, the topic is raising children with values in a world of materialism. And the truth is, I think materialism is about a lot more than just money. But money's a biggie, and we're all struggling with it in our communities. And just like everything else that we have to teach our children, it is so much easier to do if we start little than if we try to teach about the value of money when they're already carrying wallets. We have to start teaching about money before they have it in their pockets. If you wait until they're carrying it themselves and paying their own way, way too late. So the first thing is start teaching early. The second is you have to realize that your words and actions make a huge difference. If you are talking about the value of money and you have to be careful and you want to spend wisely, but you impulse buy with your children, you live beyond your means or go on a fancy vacation and then say, oh, but we can't buy any books, we have no money. You have to realize, what are you teaching in your actions? And you have to be sure that your actions match your words, especially because at the same age that children come into their own financially, that we do give them some rights with their own money, that they're out in the world, they're in the adolescence where into their adolescence where adolescents are absolutely fantastic finders of hypocrisy. They will look for the chink in your armor, and if you are telling them, be wise, be saveful, be mindful, be planful with your money, and you are not, they will catch you. They will absolutely find where you are not walking the walk and talking the talk if you are telling them one thing and doing another. Watch carefully for the incredible power of keeping up with the Joneses or the Schwartzes or the Cohens or whoever we want to call it. It is subtle, but it is there. My youngest son loves this show on TV, the House Makeover? The show I mean, where they make over a house? The Extreme Home Makeover. So after about the second or third time it was on TV, I have a nice house. I don't have the best house in the neighborhood. I don't live in the most affluent section, but we have everything we would need in our house. So my 12-year-old says, why can't we write to Extreme Home Makeover? Let's have them come. We need a den. You know, wouldn't it be nice? You always said you want a bedroom on the first floor. Let's write them a letter. I put my arm around him and I said, sweetheart, what have you noticed about the families on Extreme Home Makeover? One family had a blind child. Another family lost a parent. Another family was living, literally in a hovel. I said, thank God we have everything we need. Well, maybe, God willing, one day we'll have enough to build the dense, but we're not. Thank God we are not an Extreme Home Makeover family. Thank God. It's an opportunity to teach that lesson all the time when kids come and say, why can't we? How come we don't? We have to help them focus, again, without being Pollyannish, but we have to help them focus on, you know what? We're not doing too bad. We're doing okay, and we have an awful lot. Think ahead. Prepare for the inevitable. Before everybody is packing for Pesach and going for their 9 days to the Caribbean, to the Riviera, if you're not going, again, Erev Seder is not the time to announce to the kids, by the way, we're not in that class, we don't do those things. You have to give kids time because, again, it is very, very natural for young children, older children, to be resentful, disappointed, sad when they can't live at the same level as the people around them, as the most affluent, or whether it's by your choice or whether it's all you're able to do. So by preparing kids ahead of time, thinking ahead of time, it can be very helpful. I'm not going to talk about there are many books out there about how to put children on budgets and how to teach them financial responsibility. And the truth is there are different schools of thought about it. My feeling is that, again, if you start young and start little, that if you start with small allowances and small amounts of money, that it is so much easier to teach a child to manage a dollar a week when they are in, you know, third grade or second grade, than to start with, you know, the $10 a week or $25 or $40 or $50 a week that kids are getting in high school and expect them to be able to manage it. And that if you start early saying, here are the parameters, what goes to tzedakah, to charity, what goes to savings, and what goes to spending, that those are the three basic piles that money goes into, that you can give kids the structures that helps them that helps them save. And I happen to come from a family of financiers, you know, in accounting and in that field, and it's actually been wonderful to talk with kids about, well, what is interest and what are stocks, and somebody gave them an Israeli bond, so what is a bond and how do bonds work? And it's, I think it's actually a very good part of a child's education to learn about their diversified portfolio, and that there are different kinds of money, and that what you have in your pocket is not the same as what you have in the bank, and that they have different purposes and different uses. Okay, the last part I want to talk about, and be sure we have, I'm running out of time, because it sounds like it doesn't fit here. The last thing I want to say is that we teach our children values in a materialistic world when we set limits. And this is good. People are going to say, what, set limits, discipline, where does discipline go in here? It goes in here because if we do not set limits on our children, if we do not discipline them, then they have a sense that they are constantly and forever the center of the universe, that everything can and should come to them, that everything revolves around them, and that is the opposite of a child who grows up with true core values, who understands and believes that we are all citizens of the world, that we are each responsible for each other and not just for our own selfish needs. Limits help children learn to delay gratification. My disaster is when a parent comes to me with an adolescent child and says, they were really fine up till now, Dr. Novick, because we never said no. Now that we have to say no, we have trouble. Up until now, they were a great kid. If you didn't say no till adolescence, do I have a job cut out ahead of me? And so do you as parents. Start saying no early on, very early on. And when parents say, but I can't, it breaks my heart, I hate to. You know, here's what I want to say to you as parents. The world is not always going to give your child yes. It's a cruel world out there, and your child is going to hear no. I don't know about you. I'd rather they hear it first from me, someone who loves them more than life itself. I don't want their first experience at no to come from the cruel world. I want them to learn it in the context of a parent's love. I want them to understand that just because you can't have everything you want at the moment you want, not only can you survive it, you'll be better for it, and I still love you, even though I'm withholding something. I'm doing it literally to help you grow and for your benefit. Limits help children learn that there are others with needs, and limits and consequences teach children cause and effect. If I do this, this is what happens. If I do my homework, I get my allowance. Or if I do my homework, I get to watch TV. How are we going to become responsible adults if we never learn that our actions lead to a certain and specific reaction? And I guess I want to leave you with the notion of the values of caring that on this slide, I actually believe, go from the bottom up. And that's that the first thing we're responsible really to teach our children is empathy, is to be able to put themselves in another person's shoes, to be able to feel what another person feels. And we do this constantly, saying, how do you think your little brother feels? Don't you think grandma would like a kiss? We're constantly, from a very young age, teaching them, but we can't stop at the young age. And it's much harder to talk about the empathic response when kids get older and to say, how do you think Yessie feels when you don't let him play in your ball game? How do you think Sarah feels when you invited her two best friends but not her to the party? And we have to address those failures of empathy. Then we have to teach our children responsibility. That it's very nice to say, gee, my heart breaks when the world's heart breaks, but the next step is, okay, so then what do I do about it? I have to be a responsible person and say, it's up to me to do tikkun olam, to correct the problems in the world. I can't look to anybody else if I don't look to myself. And then going up this care backwards, everything's an acronym because I can't remember anything otherwise, is I have to take action. I can't just say, yes, I'm responsible, I have to do something, I have to act, and I have to act in a way that's actually going to bring about change. And finally, I must belong. I have to recognize that I am part of a community, that I am not an island. It's not just about my family, it's not just about my needs, but I belong to a larger whole. And when we do that, we truly raise children with values, even in the context of a very, very challenging environment. And I think that when we do that, we not only create caring children, but we truly create citizens of the world who have the ability to give us the best nachas a parent can have. You know, it's great when they get good grades. It's nice when they win the sports match. Nothing. I really believe that as a parent, nothing has ever made my heart sing as when somebody tells you, what a nice boy. That's what we want. So on that note, let me stop. I know that we're running very, very late. We have a few minutes. And thank you all very much. And take comments and questions. Yes. No, no. I mean, none of us have to go throw out all our stuff and be poor. You can raise children with incredible values. There again, we recently in our neck of the woods had highlights of a family was highlighted of an incredible benefactor philanthropist who's extremely extremely wealthy, and they were writing the profile of the story. So I shared it with the kids I work with and with my children at home, saying, do you see? You can have a huge amount of money, and you can be a ganef, you can be a robber baron, or you can be a really wonderful person. The money doesn't decide who and what you are. And I think that in some ways it's harder, you know, you have to make the extra effort if you have so much to teach children the value of it, because they come to expect it. Children who work hard for it know the value of it. They had to work hard for it. But I don't think it comes, it necessarily follows that if my children have everything, 3 minutes, if my children have everything, then they're going to grow up spoiled. Sorry, second point.
My question is kind of related. When you make rewards and punishment tied to material things, as you said, you get allowance for doing your homework, or maybe you get money taken away, or
right.
physical things taken or given, or
right.
know, as rewards and punishment, does that sort of emphasize a materialism that
okay, so the answer is that people raise their hands before in the room of how many people here work for pay outside their home. Any one of you want to give up your paycheck because you think it's fostering your materialism and you would rather just work for a pat on the back from your employer? I'm not prepared to do that. And I don't. I don't think in and of itself. However, for raising children, it is critical that we pair any tangible, monetary, material reinforcement with what really matters, which is our pride, our joy, our love, our excitement, and that we not, one of the problems that happens is that, like, we up the ante. So it'll be, well, you know, Ma, last time I got 100 on a spelling test, I got rollerblades, so this time I want a car. You know, last time I did well on my report card, we went to Disney, so it's a Cancun this time. You know, you got to make very small material rewards and not these huge ones that then, like, where do you go from here? The other thing I prefer, if I'm going to use material rewards at all with kids, is I like giving them the opportunity to use it rather than ownership. So, for example, I will say to a parent, if you want to bring Xbox into the house, they're not getting Xbox as the reward. They're not earning Xbox. They're earning Xbox access. You own the Xbox. The parent owns the Xbox. The reward is not that Xbox is coming into the house. What you're earning is time to have access to it. You're not earning a pair of rollerblades. You're earning rollerblade rental usage. So that it's not the materialism so much as the activity that you're gaining. And one of the things that we as parents have to look at is, this is the next talk on time management, is are we paying our children not to spend time with them? Are we saying, I'll give you rollerblades because I'm too busy to play Candyland? The best rewards that we can give our children is ourselves. The best reward, no matter what age they are, is giving them time with you doing activities. But we're so busy that sometimes it's much more easy to say, I'll buy you those Nikes you wanted, you know?
You said that we're role models for our children, and this is the hardest age that you think for children to grow up in. And I think that's because there's a lot of emphasis and aiming at children to be these material, greedy, wanting everything, self-centered people. If we just sort of accept it and try to override it with values while we accept society as it is, what kind of role models are we for our children?
I think it's an excellent point, and I think that to the extent that all of us make choices in our lives where we don't accept it, whether it's through activism or whether it's through works of chesed where we say, I am going to right the wrongs of the world in some little way, that we are very important role models to our children. And if we don't do that, in other words, you can't raise children saying, you have to fix the world. You can't just think about yourself, but you sit at home and watch TV and say, gee, football game's good tonight. Honey, can you bring me a beer? You can't do that. You absolutely can't do that. So we do have to show in our actions that injustices, inequities, these are things that we will work, again, in whatever way works for you to get beyond. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The question is, what do you do when grandparents don't support your values? So you may say, we don't buy brand names, we're proud Kmart shoppers, but grandma's designer labels only. One of the things that parents forget about children is they are remarkably savvy about what I call the rules of the room. Children learn from a very early age what they can do at grandma's that they can't do at mom's, whose friend's house they have to take the shoes off before they walk on the carpet, where you can jump on the sofa and where you can't. It is perfectly all right to identify that difference for our children and to say, grandma likes to give you designer clothes. It gives her a lot of pleasure, and we won't stop grandma even though we don't buy those kind of clothes usually. But it's a nice treat that you get them every once in a while from grandma. And of course, you know, the right thing to do when you get a gift from someone is to say thank you and end it there. And children, again, will be remarkably able to understand that just because grandma buys me that doesn't mean mom and dad are going to buy you. Would it be easier if we were all on the same page? Of course. Right. Well, again, that's just, I know we have to stop, but that's exactly the same as a child who would be asking grandma for 17 ice cream sundaes. A parent would have to step in and say, it's very nice, right, it's very nice, but you can't have too much ice cream, you'll get a bellyache. Thank you.